such moments, Wilson always experienced an adrenaline rush. To him, the Afghans were not victims. They were almost mythological characters out of a legend, with their long beards, their burning eyes, their refusal to admit pain or fear or doubt. To him, they symbolized the raw essence of freedom and self-determination. His inner voices would tell him that it was his destiny to be the only congressman to come here, to be the only one who could see what these warriors could do to wreak havoc on the Soviets if they were only given the tools. In a curious way, Howard Hart came the closest of anyone in a position of power in the U.S. government to sharing Wilson's passion for the Afghan cause. By this time, however, Hart had come to loathe Charlie Wilson, and he was horrified to learn that the congressman was back in his territory. Hart was careful not to criticize Wilson openly, but with winks and inflections he went to some trouble to make sure his counterpart, Pakistan's Chief of Intelligence General Akhtar, knew that Wilson was bad news and that it would be best not to deal with him. Even a decade later, Hart would still be under the impression that Akhtar and Zia shared his dislike and mistrust of the congressman. Hart's reading of the Pakistani's reaction to Charlie Wilson may well have been his single greatest intelligence misjudgment. Still, it is hard not to be sympathetic with Howard Hart. By the rules of the Cold War, the only way an American station chief could operate effectively was if he could play with a hidden deck of cards. Otherwise, the CIA might as well have turned its account over to the State Department. According to this logic, Hart needed to be the source of all secret U.S. information to his Pakistani counterparts. Yet Wilson was running about stripping the bedcovers off his delicate operation, not only suggesting that Hart and the CIA were timid, but claiming that he could force them to play a bigger and bolder game. He was, quite simply, wrecking the special advantage that a CIA official like Hart has in dealing with a country like Pakistan. Hart did not realize all of this at first, but he intuitively understood that there was an alien force moving about in his carefully seeded garden. His disadvantage was that Wilson had a far larger field of vision than he did, larger even than that of the CIA director or the White House, because the bottom line in all government programs is money from Congress, and, unlike almost everyone else, Wilson always had a sense of what was possible and what was not in his world of appropriations. He was certain of one thing. It would be easy to get more money for this CIA program. In fact, he suspected that he could get his committee to appropriate more money whether Langley wanted it or not. In reality, what he was already plotting with the Pakistanis was far more radical than anything Hart could have imagined. For example, years later, when Hart was asked if he knew about Wilson's efforts to bring the Israelis into the Afghan war, he dismissed this story out of hand, insisting that the Pakistanis would never have permitted it. "I would have burst into hysterical laughter and locked myself in the bathroom before proposing such a thing," he said. "It was bad enough for Zia to be dealing with the Americans even secretly, but the Israelis were so beyond the pale that it would have been impossible. You have to understand that the Pakistanis were counting on maintaining the image of holding the high moral ground, of a religious brother helping a religious brother. It's beyond comprehension to have tried to bring the Israelis into it." Yet, right under Hart's nose, Wilson had proposed just such an arrangement, and Zia and his high command had signed on to implement it. 7 years later, Hart still knew nothing about it. He had seen only the grotesque vision of a drunken congressman, stained by a drug scandal and blundering about the Islamic world with a belly dancer in tow. "He was just a terribly egregious fellow," he says. "I found Charlie to be repugnant." As far as Hart was concerned, this was a man no true Muslim could tolerate. He might have asked why this congressman, so offensive to the Pakistanis, was permitted to take his secretary to the Khyber Pass, when just a week before, Hart himself had been denied permission to go there. In fact, President Zia had exercised his martial law authority to grant Charlie the right to show his girlfriend the legendary gateway to Afghanistan. For Carol Shannon, sitting queen-like in the convoy's lead vehicle as it made its way up the forbidden mountainous road that spring day, it was yet another fantasy come true. 5 miles out of Peshawar, she was told they were crossing into the tribal zone, where no nation's law prevails. Pakistani law would protect them as long as they remained on this narrow road, but once they were off it, for hundreds of miles the tribes ruled. The convoy took them past giant walled compounds where the Afghan drug lords lived, and then into Lendi Kotal, the last town before the pass where the Afridi tribesmen openly pursued their ancient and honorable trade in opium and hashish. When Rudyard Kipling wrote about the goings-on in these lands, he described the endless war of espionage that the British and Russians waged against each other here during the 19th and early 20th centuries as the Great Game. Neither imperial power had been willing to permit the other to gain control of this keystone of Central Asia, yet neither was willing to resort to all-out war. For most of the time, they had chosen to fight through surrogates. The Soviets had rewritten the rules of the Great Game on December 27, 1979, when they'd sent their 40th Army in to occupy Afghanistan. At the Khyber Pass that spring day 3 years later, Carol Shannon watched with wide eyes as her hero made his own move to enter the Great Game. At the barracks of the Khyber Rifles, a Pakistani colonel pointed down to the legendary pass where invading armies since Alexander had entered and exited Afghanistan. Carol could actually hear artillery fire and see puffs of smoke where the Red Army was punishing the resistance. It was not like a movie, it was real. You could just feel how powerful Russia was. While Carol was getting her first look at war from the Khyber lookout point, off to the side, Wilson was meeting with a group of Zia's generals, urging them to let Israeli technology multiply their tanks' killing power. He told them they would need it if the Red Army ever followed through on its threats and stormed the frontier, or if the Indian Army continued its massive buildup. He explained that he wasn't asking them to like the Israelis or to acknowledge any dealings with them. He was simply saying it was good for Pakistan, good for the Afghans, and it could be kept a secret. For these generals, talking to Charlie Wilson was an altogether new and seductive experience. For once, a powerful U.S. official was not harping on what couldn't be done or what shouldn't be done, or suggesting anything other than triumphant outcomes. He was, in an eerie way, the very messenger for whom they'd been longing. Yaqub Khan, that towering intellectual figure who had served as Zia's commanding officer before becoming his foreign minister, has a theory about why Charlie Wilson had such a large impact on the Pakistan military. He explains, "Armies exist to win on the battlefield, and once defeated they cannot rest until defeat has been avenged."